Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to episode 82 of the Absolute Return Podcast. I am Julian Klimochko.
And I'm Mike Kesslering.
Today is August 17th, 2020. A few interesting things to chat about on the podcast this week, just going over notable events and market insights that we think are really important for investors to take note of, to analyze, and really recognize what it means and any potential effect on their investments. First off, we wanted to chat about massive, massive news in the Bitcoin space. That is when MicroStrategy, which is a $1 billion technology company, they announced a $250 million investment into Bitcoin. Will other institutional investors follow? We're going to chat about their thesis behind that massive nine-figure allocation to cryptocurrency. Airbnb, they once again are going to pursue an IPO such that they could be public by the end of the year. Are they going to pursue potentially a SPAC? Lastly, we wanted to talk about Barry Diller's. His IAC conglomerate made a $1 billion bet on casino giant MGM. And Barry Diller is a guy who has just nailed it in terms of recognizing these developments in whether they be traditional media, internet space. He's been right time and time again. So we want to chat about his thesis on the online gaming market, which is a rapidly growing space. Wanted to chat about his thesis behind that investment because it's certainly non-consensus and some people were taken by surprise. But first, let's get to this massive Bitcoin news. So NASDAQ-listed software company MicroStrategy, they have roughly a $1.4 billion market cap. They announced that they invested $250 million of their balance sheet into Bitcoin. Now, at the time, their market cap was closer to $1 billion. So basically 25% of the company they put into the leading cryptocurrency. Their shares did rally pretty significantly off of this. And I just wanted to touch on a number of comments from MicroStrategy's CEO, Michael Saylor. He really outlined their thesis with respect to this nine-figure investment into Bitcoin, which is really the first institutional allocation to that asset class. So he said, our investment in Bitcoin is part of our new capital allocation strategy, which seeks to maximize long-term value for our shareholders. This investment reflects our belief that Bitcoin, as the world's most widely adopted cryptocurrency, is a dependable store of value and an attractive investment asset with more long-term appreciation potential than holding cash. And that quote is important to me, basically on one main tenet, and that is cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin, as an investable asset class. Historically, it has been, well, a dozen years ago, it wasn't anything. It was invented in 2009, slowly built its reputation, and ever since then, it was really more so known as a speculative asset, more so of a gamble. Many investors didn't understand it, concerned that it was some sort of scam, scheme, going to zero. However, you know, as we see this more and more often, and certainly MicroStrategy is not going to be the one and only institutional investor that does this, it's going to become more and more recognized as a legitimate asset class, as it has on this MicroStrategy investment. I mean, no one allocates $250 million without a very thorough review process and significant thought into it. So the CEO of MicroStrategy continues. He indicated, our decision to invest in Bitcoin at this time was driven in part by a confluence of macro factors affecting the economic and business landscape that we believe is creating long-term risks for our corporate treasury program, risks that should be addressed proactively. Those macro factors include, among other things, the economic and public health crisis precipitated by COVID-19, unprecedented government financial stimulus measures, including quantitative easing adopted around the world, and global political and economic uncertainty. He continues, we believe that together, these and other factors may well have a significant depreciating effect on the long-term real value of fiat currencies and many other conventional asset types. including many of the assets traditionally held as part of corporate treasury operations, end quote. Let me translate that for you. He's looking out, reading the tea leaves, looking at the environment, and is obviously concerned with respect to tens of trillions of dollars in basically money printing, fiscal and monetary stimulus by governments worldwide, central banks worldwide, that, you know, each time the money printer is turned on, you lose some faith in non-asset-backed fiat currencies. I mean, the notion of paper money is still very new with respect to how long humans have engaged in commerce, which is, you know, thousands of years, perhaps tens of thousands of years, and paper currency, I mean, you know, that's basically a generation or two with respect to currency not being backed by gold or some other sort of hard asset. So clearly, MicroStrategy's leadership being very concerned about a potential rapid depreciation in the US dollar, basically high rates of inflation, given the dramatic increase in the printing of money. And in my opinion, that's a valid concern. Not a lot of people are thinking that way. Obviously, we're in a huge bond bull market. 10-year bonds are yielding, what, 60 basis points? And so, you know, this is certainly a non-consensus view that he has, but the job as a capital allocator is to notice these risks and be proactive about tackling this potential risk on a balance sheet. And he really nails it here. Is, you know, if you think there's going to be a rapid and sudden depreciation in the dollar due to substantial money printing, which we've seen time and time again, whether it be like Weimar Germany, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, et cetera, certainly wouldn't be the first time, but everyone believes that a stable US dollar is just, you know, a rule of law. Meanwhile, with $10 trillion in stimulus just this year, you know, it's not out of the question to see this sort of doomsday scenario that they're outlining within their thesis here. Not saying it's guaranteed to happen, but certainly they see it as a risk, as should, I think, other investors. And you don't sort of position your entire portfolio to be ready for that, but you certainly should position some of a portfolio to, you know, consider that type of situation. What are your thoughts on this really, really interesting allocation, not just to Bitcoin, but the underlying thesis behind it?
Yeah, I would agree with your reading of the situation, where it's less of a like a bullish view of Bitcoin than more a bearish stance and the tail risk that they see.
Yeah,
in
that's
their
a good
current
point.
Program.
Yeah, because I don't foresee this as a speculative bet.
And no.
Historically, we've seen many people make speculative bets on cryptocurrency. This is more recognizing Bitcoin potentially as a digital gold, something that can maintain value.
Yeah, certainly. And in terms of, I guess there's a few things here. So I thought it was very interesting that the company, they chose the direct purchase of BTC as opposed to using a derivative product, say Bitcoin futures contracts or an exchange-traded fund like closed-end fund GBTC. So they will have to handle their custody on their own, which will be interesting. So there are a variety of, there's a number of great custody solutions in the Bitcoin space by this time. So from a treasury perspective, once they do that upfront work of finding a custody solution and organizing all that from an operational perspective, it likely will be easier operationally than rolling treasuries constantly.
For sure.
So that part is very interesting.
Well, the other thing to comment on that notion is they bought over 21,000 bitcoins, which is 0.1% of the entire supply. So, I mean, on the future side, that's like a massive position to be rolling every month. So I don't think that'd be like necessarily technically possible, given like that the futures market isn't very liquid at this point, especially for that size. I mean, $250 million position, that's fairly sizable.
Yeah, that's a little too large for the futures market. But yeah, as you had mentioned, the stock is up on the announcement. Now, there was a tender offer that the company put out, but would like to point out that it is trading above the tender offer terms. So it's trading through that. So it's very notable that the market is reacting very favorably to this. So you have to think that corporate finance departments and treasury teams in many other companies are looking at this. I mean, I believe it was the blog Adventures in Capitalism came out with a note about this today as well. And his comment was all of those management teams have options within their company, and seeing price reaction like this, just the incentive to follow this move now that you have an institutional player who has already stuck their neck out, that leaves away some of the legal tail risk as a fiduciary.
Yeah,
and so you're
going
to see tons follow.
But as I indicated with respect to additional institutional players getting involved, no one ever wants to be first because that really risks significant reputational capital. However, if you're the 10th person to do it, then, you know, it's much less so, right? So that's a really good point.
Yeah, yeah, and basically just that you're likely to see a few other companies come out and do this as well in the coming months. And it'll be interesting once some bigger, more household names adopt a similar strategy. And as well, when you're bringing up the tail risk of just USD, which is, you outlined a lot of the solid rationale there, but as well as short-term treasuries, right? If the US does go to negative rates, I mean, you're effectively just locking in a loss. Whereas with Bitcoin, there is a risk that there is volatility there. It can go down. But if you do have a bullish stance, there could be reason for price appreciation there.
Yeah, and at this point, treasuries are yielding negative on a real basis. So inflation adjusted, you lose your purchasing power each and every year with the paltry yields at this point. But Mike, what's your thoughts on who's going to be next?
I'd really have no estimates. I mean, Tesla would be an interesting option. That would be right up Elon's alley.
Or perhaps one of Jack Dorsey's companies, Square or Twitter. I think that could be a good call. He's obviously a huge
especially
fan of
Square,
Bitcoin.
Square, Twitter, or with Square, they are already integrated with crypto. So
sure.
It would be
that
a
makes
simple
sense,
fit.
But. My dark horse pick, Berkshire Hathaway. I mean, they just announced a large stake in Barrick Gold, so perhaps, who knows? I know that Barrick investment was either Todd or Ted, and maybe they got the crypto bug. You never know. Could get Berkshire's stock actually performing this year.
Real gold and digital gold. They have all their bases covered then.
Yeah, there you go. Nonetheless, MicroStrategy stock up 18% on the week. And like I said, this is going to be the start of a major trend. We're going to see more and more 8 to 9 figure bets on Bitcoin, and at the end of the day, there's only 21 million outstanding. And as that supply goes to long-term holders, then basic supply-demand economics 101 indicates, well, where's the price going to go? Likely going to go up. So super, super interesting Bitcoin news. Now let's get to Airbnb, who basically had quite the V-shaped recovery, didn't they? A few months ago, we talked about the distressed financing that Airbnb conducted with private equity firm Silver Lake just a few months ago, where it slashed their valuation to $18 billion, down from an earlier valuation of $31 billion, in order to just make it through the COVID crisis. Their business absolutely evaporated down significantly. However, business has bounced back dramatically. They did have to lay off a quarter of their staff in May prior to the bounce back, but now they're on much better footing. Business is looking great, and now an IPO is back on the table for 2020 after they recently shelved these plans. One question that the market has is, how are they going to choose to go public? It could be via traditional IPO, could be via direct listing, which we saw Spotify did that. And did we see any other sort of high-profile names?
Spotify was the highest-profile name. There's been a few other smaller tech companies, but definitely Spotify, the highest-profile.
But they could also be looking at one of the hottest asset classes out there, the SPAC. And for the valuation that Airbnb is likely looking at, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it was above $30 billion again. Who knows? There's not a lot of SPACs that could handle that. Perhaps it could be the Pershing Square SPAC. Other than that, maybe one of the other ones over $1 billion. But that could be a stretch. Would be super interesting to see them go public through a special purpose acquisition company, because that would really, you know, blow the top off the bear market if we saw the preeminent IPO candidate go public that way instead of a traditional IPO. would be pretty stunning. Nonetheless, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs got the advisory mandate engaged to lead this offering. We're not sure if it's going to entail a capital raise as well. As we discussed recently, did a financing just a handful of months ago with Silver Lake and other participants. As for some stats on IPOs, so U.S. listed IPOs have raised more than $60 billion so far in 2020. Obviously, we went through quite the bear market where IPOs, basically that window shut, but it opened wide open shortly after because the $60 billion raised so far in 2020 is the highest level since the middle of the tech boom in 2000. In addition, on average, IPOs this year have risen 23% in their first day of trading. This is the biggest first-day IPO pop since the year 2000. So a lot of comparisons to the year 2000. We got the NASDAQ just going absolute bananas. I saw Donald Trump tweeted noting that it hit a new all-time high on the NASDAQ today, which he seems to be obsessed with the stock market indices. But I digress. This Airbnb situation, super, super interesting. What do you think is going to happen? Are they going to use the SPAC, traditional IPO, or direct listing?
Yeah, when looking at the different options, I guess, the traditional IPO, really good for the roadshow process, really getting institutional investors on board with the story. But then, you know, like you're going through that whole roadshow process with the valuation at the end, that it's finally agreed to at the end. And it takes a lot of time for the company, and it's a big process for the management team.
Whereas I think that's less so over the past few months because it was all virtual, right? Mm-hmm. It's like they're not traveling from town to town. They're basically just doing an online presentation. But like you said, you're trying to sell to many, many multiple.
Yeah, negotiating
accounts
with multiple different parties. We've talked about the IPO pop before as well. So there's the pricing mechanism that some feel is quite broken. Direct listing for them can really work. It really, for me, I think the two most logical options would be the direct listing or a public listing through a SPAC, where a direct listing, that can work because they're such a household name for the brand. Many people are familiar with the stock, so they could get a lot of retail involvement.
For sure.
But it really comes down to the choice, just really comes down to how much capital they're needing to raise. A SPAC deal really would likely result in whichever SPAC they chose, as you had mentioned, not too many options, but that SPAC would trade above NAV. That's pretty,
sure.
I would be very surprised if they announced one and it did not trade above NAV. So the chances that the full trust amount would remain post-close, that seems almost certain. But as well, so there's a few that are 500 plus, there's quite a few that are over 500 plus million in their trust. And then only, you know, three or four that have over a billion.
Mm-hmm.
But what really can make the difference is pretty much every SPAC deal announced lately has had a concurrent private investment in public equity financing.
So yeah,
the acronym PIPE. They've had quite large pipes with them. And so in terms of that, you could really increase the capital injection quite easily. But by all accounts, it looks like they're going to be raising a decent amount of money, as I believe through the first half of the year this year, they've lost around over $700 million.
Huh.
That's not on a cash flow basis. That's just on a GAAP basis, I believe. But yeah, so they're going to be raising a decent amount of capital. So their number of SPACs are limited, but there is plenty of advantages in terms of the time to actually getting to market. They announce a SPAC deal, it's about 3 months till deal close. Whereas even without the travel of a traditional IPO, you still do have the roadshow process that is a lot longer than 3 months. So it'll be very interesting to see if they go this route. You know, they've already been delayed once because of the pandemic back in March. So yeah, it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, I would really like to see them go through the SPAC, as it would provide just further proof of concept that and legitimacy to the SPAC as a vehicle.
Oh, for certain, that would really be a crowning achievement of the asset class. And where the asset class does have a competitive advantage is timing and speed. Obviously, we are in a super hot market for startup unicorns, super hot market for IPOs, and just a on-fire market for SPACs. If they want to be public by 2020, that's perhaps the route to go, because, I mean, you only have like 5 months left of the year. So, you know, I think that there's a decent chance that they will pursue that type of structure in order to go public, such that we could see a listing by the end of 2020. So interesting news for Airbnb, but one executive that makes a move that I always want to follow is Barry Diller. He's a guy that's been around forever. He runs internet and media conglomerate IAC. He's had quite the career. He started out in TV, extremely successful, just massive, massive wins, truly innovative. Went on to the movie business, again, hugely successful in a new type of business. Then went on, read the tea leaves, saw the media business changing and the internet as this new growth engine, transitioned to internet businesses, massive, massive wins back to back to back. So I take notice when he moves into a new sector, which he did last week as IAC announced that it bought a nearly $1 billion stake in MGM Resorts, which is a casino company. Some might have thought, you know, what's he doing? It's a bit of a head scratcher. Why is, I thought this was an internet company. Why is IAC going into gambling? However, MGM does have an online gaming segment, and that's really where he sees the business going, is this transition from offline to online. We saw the success of DraftKings. Really, their stock has just gone absolute bananas. So there's keen investor sentiment on the space. And clearly, as the states throughout the US, each one goes through their own process of legalizing online gambling, which is going to happen because, I mean, they all need that tax revenue, right? And it's becoming more and more normalized as, you know, Las Vegas, New Jersey, and other jurisdictions do it. That's really where this business is going to be heading. So IAC is trying to get in on the ground floor through this MGM investment. So super notable investment. And when Barry Diller makes a move, investors should take note. What are your thoughts on this really interesting and perhaps innovative investment from Barry Diller?
Yeah, and it certainly was, because typically the playbook for IAC was taking majority stakes in private companies that were already pure plays in the online space. But looking at the headlines, investors immediately were saying, you know, what are you doing? This is outside of your typical playbook. But when looking back, really, it's all about just taking businesses off that were successful business models offline to the online space. So as you had mentioned with his past successes, for some of the folks that aren't aware, for industries such as dating, they had Match Group, which has Tinder, Hinge, as well as Match, I think Plenty of Fish. Ticketing, they have Ticketmaster, which he built up. Travel, they had Expedia. Home services, they had Angi. And so he has such a, as you had mentioned, just a great track record of doing this. And so they mentioned that this was a once in a decade opportunity for them. And so this was what they decided to do with $1 billion of their cash. They still do have $3 billion of cash to allocate. But going into their thesis, they did say that they had been looking at the online gaming space for a while, and that this was the best way for them to get their exposure. And in their shareholder letter, they gave a little bit more rationale into this. First being that to operate in sports betting and digital gaming, that a provider is required to have a partner with a local casino operator. And so MGM is currently in 7 states, and by the end of the year, they're going to be in 11. So they already have a little bit of a scale advantage in terms of the number of states that they are already operational in. As well, they do have one thing that they did focus on was the MGM brand advantage. And they likened it to the advantage that Disney has in streaming, yeah, where the brand has multiple avenues to monetize the IP. And so that's where I think he's taking a lot of optionality here, is they still have their core hospitality and gaming business in the physical realm, that this is just another way to monetize their IP, which is just their brand.
Yeah, you gotta think, say, 10 years down the line, say if online gaming is legalized everywhere, that will sprout, you know, a tremendous amount of competitors. How do you differentiate yourself as a preeminent place to gamble on your phone, on an app? Well, certainly if you have the brand name that MGM has, that's truly a differentiating factor.
Everybody knows that brand, right?
For sure.
And so that's where he also likened MGM's core business with its free cash flow yield of 10%. So that, as you mentioned, in 10 years, if its free cash flow yield is 10%, by their calculations, that's going to be a good investment in 10 years, assuming that it's not just a melting ice cube. But they really likened the investment thesis that they have for MGM with the own thesis of IAC, where it's a sum of the parts story where the stub trades at an implied value of effectively zero.
So the stub means you net off its cash and investments and then now analyze it on a sort of sum of the parts basis.
Exactly, yeah. And so they're really comparing it to IAC itself, where now that people do need to remember that they still have $3 billion of cash to deploy and no debt. And historically, a cash pile in front of Barry Diller has been a very successful proposition for investors. And they do have another a variety of ways that they can play it. They could put more money into the MGM investment in terms of building out a roll-up strategy within MGM. I view that as somewhat unlikely, though he does like to keep a diversified basket of investments, which is quite prudent on his behalf. But I would like to point out MGM being up since the announcement, I believe over 10%, and IAC is actually down 5% since the announcement. So very interesting to follow here. And Just as Julian had mentioned, Barry Diller is someone that I very much look up to. And so whenever he's taking a look at a space, it's good to take note.
He's certainly one of these storied executives a la John Malone or Warren Buffett. You know, whenever they make a big deal, investors should take note. You should analyze what they're doing, understand the thesis behind it, because Barry Diller is the type of guy that has a tremendous track record of success, shareholder value generation, and he just has back-to-back-to-back wins. And so he makes a huge billion-dollar bet like this. You got to think that his thesis is pretty strong and he has conviction in it. When a guy like that has conviction, you know, my ears sort of perk up, and investors should definitely take notice. So that about wraps it up, ladies and gents, for episode 82 of the Absolute Return Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. If you did, you can check out more episodes on absolutereturnpodcast.com. Definitely check us out on the Twitter universe. Mike, what's your handle on that social media network?
It is M_Kesslering.
And you can find me on Twitter at Julian Klimochko, KLYMOCHKO. And until next week, folks, wish you all the best in your trading and speculating, and we'll chat with you soon. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.